From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fairfax, California.
Glen Park.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Coming up, why many schools want to go charter.
Charter schools have control over their own budgets. We'll have more freedom to make decisions about our curriculum and instruction.
Then we'll hear about a tech company that measures success not by profit, but by service to humanity.
I now spend 10 or 20% of my time on field building, kind of cheerleading. Yeah, you can do this. It's okay to not make money and do good with technology.
And we celebrate the men who brought us into the world.
And I remember my daughter, you, saying that you didn't want to do what your dad did, you know, and here you are doing the same thing.
A tribute to dads and more coming right up on Cross Currents. As the school year draws to a close, here's something to think about this summer. The National Alliance for Public Charter Schools released a study yesterday that reveals an increasing number of students nationwide are on waiting lists to get into charter schools. This year, that number has surpassed 600,000 students nationwide, nearly double what it was just 3 years ago. Out of the 519 new charter schools that started up in the 2010-2011 school year, 119 of them were in California. In Oakland, Arise, Envision, Unity, Ascend, Learning Without Limits, they're all inspirational words and also the names of Oakland schools. These are just a few of the charter schools ushered into the district during the past 10 years. Learning Without Limits is one of the most recent to convert from traditional to charter. Along with Ascend, it was granted its petition to become a charter school this past March for the upcoming academic year. That means that the school will no longer receive funding through the district. Instead, it will come directly from the state. It also means that the school will have more autonomy. But change seldom comes without a cost. KALW's Jordan Katz has that story.
It's 8 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, and about 400 students are standing at attention. They're outside the Fruitvale Oakland Elementary School Learning Without Limits, or LWL. This is the vision statement they recite every day.
We will see!
The students' chatter turns into a dull roar as parents herd kindergartners into the school's colorful hallways. One of those parents is Kathy Cash.
I started out helping out in my daughter's classroom. I volunteer a few hours in there, and then I help out with parents that need translating in English to Spanish.
Cash is the president of the school's newly founded parents organization. She was one of the most vocal parents in talks about the school going charter. The petition was granted in March, after about a year in the making. Cash is looking forward to the school going charter. She says it'll offer teachers more autonomy, and it will give parents an even bigger say in what goes on inside classrooms.
It's very important that as parents, to be able to have the space where we can voice our opinion, and not only that, but we can actually work close with teachers. Like, we have the choice of electing the teachers that we want for our kids, along with the principal. We can feel free to actually say, well, this worked, this doesn't, and then have a curriculum that works around the things that, we actually say.
But more autonomy is just one half of the traditional versus charter school debate. To explore that debate a bit, let's back up to March 15, 2011. 16 out of LWL's 17 teachers received notices of potential layoffs that day. Concerned for the future of the school, parents and staff discussed their options. The conversation quickly turned to going charter. Leo Fuchs, principal of Learning Without Limits, says it would give the school four freedoms.
Charter schools have control over their own budgets. We'll have more freedom to make decisions about our curriculum and instruction. We'll have more freedom to make decisions about our calendar and schedule. And we'll have more freedom to make decisions about our staffing.
These four points of control are known in the public education world as the four autonomies. Parents and teachers agreed. These autonomies were what the school needed. A charter was the way to go. All they had to do was go to the school district for approval. So last November, they presented their petition to the school board. It was denied.
The downturn in revenues for the state has meant
It's put all school districts in a really difficult position.
Jody London is the Oakland School Board president. For her, denying LWL the charter had everything to do with the bottom line. States give money to districts based on student attendance. But when a school becomes a charter, that state money goes directly to the school and the district loses out.
Our initial estimates were that those two schools going charter would leave a financial hit to us of close to around $800,000 or $850,000.
That's just for two charters, Ascend and LWL. When you consider the 34 charters already in Oakland, that's a lot of money, especially for a district chronically in debt. Back in 2003, Oakland Unified's $35 million budget deficit landed the district under the state's control. London says what followed was a six-year-long budget debacle during which the deficit ballooned to $100 million. The district regained local control in 2009 and has since been working to balance its budget.
So right now in Oakland, we have 101 schools for 38,000 students.
That number doesn't include charters.
Most districts our size have between 50 and 60 schools. So the board voted in October to consolidate 7 schools and close 5. And as a result of that and some other very careful financial management tools, we think we will have closed the structural deficit, which is huge.
For now, OUSD is still in debt to the state. It owes $6 million a year until 2026. So it needs every dollar it can save. Yet over the last decade, the number of charter schools in the district has nearly doubled, and charters don't help pay down the debt. One of those schools is Ernestine C. Reams Academy of Technology and Art. It's been around for a while, since 1999. The charter, one in a row of small schools on MacArthur Boulevard, has just over 300 students. Principal Lisa Blair says when she arrived 13 years ago, students were coming in with extremely low test scores.
We found that they were anywhere from actually about 4 to 6 grades below in their reading and in their math.
Since then, scores have improved, but have yet to reach the state's benchmarks.
The goal is to reach 800, which is safe water, and 1,000, which is the max. We're currently at about 720. We've had a couple of dips over the years.
Early charter supporters thought more freedoms would help improve standardized test scores. But UC Berkeley education professor Janelle Scott says it doesn't always play out that way. Some charters do improve scores, but many remain the same. And at some, scores even drop.
That situation has raised questions, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, about, well, then what are they good for?
She says the reasoning she hears goes beyond test scores.
And in some of the charter renewal hearings, you'll hear parents say, we know the school is not performing according to the official indicators, but it's a good place for my kid. She's happy, right? She used to hate going to school. She loves it now. That should matter.
But those aren't measurable results. And Board President Jody London says OUSD also needs concrete measures to determine if a school is worth the cost.
Are they improving student achievement? You know, all these things. Is there strong leadership? Do they have a focus on continuous improvement? Is there responsible governance, fiscal accountability?
After the board rejected the charters for LWL and Ascend, the schools appealed. By March, they and the district managed to work out a compromise.
We ended up crafting a deal with these schools where basically they are charter schools and they're working with a charter management organization, but really the only thing that they're working with the charter management organization on is the hiring piece of it. They're continuing to take food service from us. They are leasing the buildings they're in, which are beautiful buildings.
In addition to buying those and a few other services back from the district,
they're going to continue to help us pay back that $100 million to the state.
Oakland gets a bad rap.
Again, Berkeley professor Janelle Scott.
I think that there's the perception that Oakland is not just the schools, but the city is just undesirable. And I think Oakland has incredible potential. There are wonderful schools with wonderful teachers and committed families.
No matter how committed Oakland's teachers and families are, they're still saddled with a multi-million dollar debt, at least for the next decade. But with continued cooperation, Oakland's schools and district will at the very least remain partners. In Oakland, I'm Jordan Katz for Cross Currents.
What do you think about the increase of public charter schools? Are your kids on a charter wait list? You can leave us a message at our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That number again to leave us a message is 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Education is made easier with the right administration, the right teachers, and the right technology if the schools can afford it. And one Silicon Valley tech company has made it easier for blind and nearly blind students by creating a machine that helps them read. The company is called Benetech, and its motto is Technology Serving Humanity. It's a different type of tech venture. It measures its success not in dollars, but by service to society and the environment. Sort of a nonprofit charity meets state-of-the-art tech company. The man who founded Benetech is Jim Fruchterman. He's a former rocket scientist turned pioneer in the field called social technology. He was named a MacArthur Fellow, a genius, for his work. Fruchterman came by our studios to talk with KALW's Hana Baba about why he chose social good over monetary profit.
So let's go back in time and remember a time when you were famously, I read this everywhere, that you were a rocket scientist. And, you know, that's like one of the coolest jobs on Earth. So when, at what point did you think you wanted to do something different and start up Benetech?
Well, I wanted to become an astronaut. I was an electrical engineer. And so I was learning how to make smart missiles because that's what they taught you when you were becoming an electrical engineer. The class was about how to make a pattern recognition system. And the professor gave the example of making a smart missile with a camera in its nose that had a representation of a tank in its memory. And then you would fire the missile and it would look around until it spotted something that looked like a tank. And it would zoom in. And zoom in and blow it up. And I had to do a project for the class, and I went back to my dorm room going, I wonder if there's a more socially beneficial application of this cool technology. And then I just thought, well, instead of recognizing tanks, you could recognize words and read them to blind people. I didn't know any blind people. I just kind of knew that in theory, this should work. And later on, I got the chance to do it.
How? Let's go through that process.
Well, so the venture capitalists in Silicon Valley invested a lot of money in a company that could make a device that could read anything for these commercial goals, routing the mail, scanning in contracts for lawyers. We built a prototype reading machine for the blind, and I demonstrated it to our board of directors, who are mainly venture capitalists. And they said, wow, cool. It scanned a page. It read it aloud using a very synthetic voice. And then they said, how big's the market? And I said, I think it's about $1 million per year. They were underwhelmed with this market opportunity. And so I talked to my lawyer. I said, the board vetoed the reading machine for the blind project, and I'm totally bummed about this. And he said, well, you could start a deliberately nonprofit high-tech company. You could start a charity that makes these. I thought it was going to be about $1 million a year break-even business. And it turned out to be a $5 million a year break-even business because our goal was not to make money. It was to make as many reading machines for the blind as we could while breaking even so that we could keep on making them.
Which is a rare goal in Silicon Valley. You say you don't measure your success in dollars. You measure it through, you know, how beneficial you are to humanity. It sounds utopian, but you're doing it, and you're like the black sheep in Silicon Valley?
Well, we were especially like black sheep about 20 years ago because people were like, you're crazy, right? You're going to take this public and you're going to pocket the money. And I said, no, if you do that with a charity, you go to jail, right? That's bad, right? Because the idea is a charity is already owned by the public, right? And so, but in the last few years, people have taken some of the focus off of the single-minded, you know, drive towards greed, right? More and more companies are saying, wait a minute, we want to be good citizens. You know, Google famously said they didn't want to be evil. Facebook has, you know, this whole expanded idea of what they're trying to do. They're trying to connect the planet. And so just making money at the expense of society is hopefully going out of fashion. And a lot of people who make money as young people are deciding to put a fair amount of that money into philanthropy. And so, though for the first 10 years, we really didn't raise any money because we were a break-even venture, then essentially the two founders of eBay, Jeff Skoll and Pierre Omidyar, became our largest backers through what's turned into be a giant growth phase into a lot of new areas, not just helping the blind.
So tell me about the business model. Is there a business model? Is there kind of a way to measure all of this?
Well, our business model at Benetech is around sustainability. How do we keep on being able to deliver social good? And technology, we make a lot of free software that we but sometimes we say, okay, it's free software. You could make a gazillion copies for free. Matter of fact, we give you permission to. But if you can afford it, it would be great if you sent us $150, right? Kind of the pledge model of public radio. And, you know, you get it for free, but hey, someone's got to pay for it. So pitch in. So in many cases, that's our model, is that we're trying to find a way for us to be able to pay our staff, not top wages, but so they can, you know, pay the rent and, you know, send their kids to school and all that kind of stuff. And so every time we start a new venture, we try to come up with three or four different ways that money would come in that would cover eventually the cost of operating that business. That's usually our goal. So I'll pick some examples. So we write software for the environmental movement. And for the last 3 or 4 years, 100% of what it's cost us to do have come from, I'd say at least 90%, from the large environmental groups. So groups like the Nature Conservancy and World Wildlife Fund use our software, and they send us checks because they want to, A, be a good citizen, and B, sometimes they have, you know, could you add this feature that would be really great for people doing wetlands restoration? Yes, we'd love to. That'll be $50,000. Have you got it? And so, but that enables us to pay engineers to do that.
You won a MacArthur Fellowship. You are officially a genius. And you're blushing over there a little
bit. No, my wife rolls her eyes when people say that. She's like, I have to live with them.
You're a MacArthur genius. Hey, they said it, not you. What did you win it for? And it does have to do with literacy and reading.
Yeah, I think that the reason MacArthur said they gave me the award, the fellowship, was because of sort of innovation around helping people with disabilities. First, by making a nonprofit reading machine for the blind company, then we sold that to a for-profit, and then used the resulting money to start Bookshare, which is our largest, well, is the largest digital library for blind people. And I think
you've served 100,000 students over 5 years?
Well, that's what we promised to do, but it looks like we're going to hit 200,000 students over the 5 years for the same amount of money.
Huh.
It's the power of sort of technology. Once you've built a big website that has, you know, 150,000 books, the cost to serve twice as many students isn't as that much more, right? Because it's about building a technology asset. So we're thinking that for the same budget, we could serve 400,000 or 500,000 students with a disability in a year. And that's what we're aiming for, because that's about the number of students in the U.S. that have a disability that keeps them from reading print normally.
And so the machine.
What's that?
The machine. Let's go back to the
Well, the original reading machine was turning a personal computer into a reading machine. So you had a scanner that plugged into your PC, and then our software would basically use the scanner to take a picture of the page, translate that into like a word processor file, and then the voice synthesizer would then read the book aloud. And of course, voice synthesizers have gotten pretty good these years.
So it recognizes letters, like this, letters.
Yeah. Letters and words.
And it would read it in that word.
And it kind of does some automatic spell checking, so it corrects some mistakes. It's like now you could scan a book and get like 99.something% accuracy. So pretty much you're able to go off and use a reading machine as a blind person to read a book independently. And then the next innovation was, we said, oh, we've got 40,000 blind people and dyslexic people using our reading machines to scan books. Let's create a website where they can legally share those books. So Bookshare is sort of, you know, Napster meets Amazon meets Talking Books to the Blind, but legal. And the idea is that it's the first library for blind people that blind people created for each other. We didn't decide what books they wanted to read.
So it's crowdsourced.
It's crowdsourced, totally. And it's been around for 10 years. And because it's so cheap when people are crowdsourcing it, that's what's made it the largest library around. So, but it's the whole idea is that you turn a book from being inaccessible, because the people we're talking about can't pick up a print book and read it, you know, because they're blind, because they're so dyslexic they can't read very well, because they have cerebral palsy, or they're a returning vet who's been injured and can't, you know, read a book very well, and it turns it into something they can use. That could be large print. It could be Braille. The most common thing is for it to be read aloud, but we have users doing all of the above.
What is this for you personally now?
After 10 years, I met my first donor and actually convinced, or he actually convinced me that I needed his help. My plan was to start a second social enterprise after the Reading Machine for the Blind venture. He said, no, if you do a second one and it's successful as the first, I'll consider you a failure. And I was like, well, stunned. Wait a minute. He said, no, your job is now for your next, you should get like 10 new ventures off the ground and you shouldn't run any of them. Someone who was like you 10 years ago should be running those. You should be cheerleading and finding them resources. And not only should you do those 10, but you should go out and catalyze 100 or 1,000 ventures like this to get started because there's all this need. And I kind of was a little taken aback, but I went, ooh, that's what I need to do. So I now spend 10 or 20% of my time on field building, kind of cheerleading. Yeah, you can do this. It's okay to not make money and do good with technology. You know, there are ways to make it successful. There's even ways to make a living doing it. And so when people tell you, hey, that doesn't make a lot of money, that's stupid, don't do it, you should say, but it does a lot of social good. I'll do it anyway.
That's Jim Fruchterman, founder and CEO of Benetech, speaking with KALW's Hana Baba. What projects would you like Benetech to take on? You can contact us through our Facebook page. We're KALW News, and just send over your ideas. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Sometimes, even when we're sure that we want to do good in the world, like Jim Fruchterman, who we just heard from, it helps to get words of advice and guidance from an older and wiser friend. These types of mentorships are hard to come by, but a group of artists decided that they would start the dialogue for one community through art. What was born out of that desire was the art installation called Question Bridge Black Males. It's a video dialogue between over 150 black men from across the country, talking about some of life's biggest topics: racism, sexuality, success, and love. And that is the question, true love, that comes from New Orleans native Darren Simon.
Well, essentially what I wanted to know from a black man who's been married for some time, 25, 35 years or so, I wanted to know as to, I'm curious as to how'd you know that she was the one for you? How'd you know that she was a woman that you wanted to marry and spend the rest of your life with? And the reason I'm asking that is because I've been dating a young woman for about a year or so, and you know, I feel that she, you know, that she could be the one for me. I just don't know what that feels like.
This is an instance in which you really have to trust yourself. For myself, I will say this, that when I met my wife, it was at the end of a period in which I had been dating a lot. And in all of the relationships that I had had, at some point, I could see the end of the relationship. I could see it coming. When I met my wife, I could not see the end. When I met the woman who became my wife, I did not know necessarily that we were going to be married, but I knew, A, that we were going to have a relationship of major significance, and I also felt, and I can't necessarily describe the feeling, but I just felt inside of myself, I could not see the end of our relationship. So what that said to me was that we could, it was not necessarily, it was not a finite dynamic that was going on between us. It felt infinite, infinite, and it was something that I could not see the end for. And that was how I knew that this woman, the woman that became my wife, was going to be majorly a part of my life.
Well, I guess that I've been with my wife now for 20 years, which doesn't qualify for that 25 or 30 that you're talking about. But when we met, we really liked being with each other. And on our first date, we just stayed together for every day after that, almost. I don't really think there is an answer to the question, is this the woman that I'm going to spend the rest of my life with? And I say that because there are many times in your life you'll meet a woman that you are infatuated with, and you fall in love, and you fall in lust, and then you think that you want to be with this woman, but you don't really know anybody until you've encountered the journey of a relationship. It's a fantasy that you will find somebody that you'll know is the one who you want to be with the rest of your life, because you don't even know her.
Well, you have the essential ingredient already. You mentioned you feel like. Your feelings are a great vibration of if it's good or bad. As far as whether or not it could be a long-lasting relationship, that's based on the collaboration between the two of you all, working with common goals and going in the same direction, having experienced marriage for 30 years, the power, passion, and the pain of being in a relationship, realizing that she is a reflection of me, and where her where there was problems and challenges, actually it was a reflection of things that I needed to deal with. So when it comes to a long-term relationship, love is a choice. Relationships also are choices. And if you choose to build and maintain a relationship, you can.
Well, in answer to your question, I dated my wife probably almost 3 years before we got married. But I knew from the time that I first met her that she was someone that I wanted to spend a lot of time with her. She was soft. She was gentle. She was understanding. I used to write my name and my last name with her first name over and over again on a yellow legal pad. I must have done that 100 times. I used to find ways to just see her because I just liked being around her. She just made me feel good. And this was before we ever started going out or anything. It's a feeling that you have. And it's not something that you question. But if you have it, you'll know it.
You just heard from Delroy Lindo, Julian T. Roberts, Greg A. Stanton, and Daryl Norton. Question Bridge, Black Males is a video art installation directed by African-American artists Chris Johnson and Hank Willis Thomas in collaboration with Biate Ross Smith and Kamal St. Clair. You can see the installation at the Oakland Museum of California through July 8th. And you can learn more about the project and its sponsors at questionbridge.com, or you can find links at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. One person who might have a good answer to the question, how do I know he's the one, is your dad. This Sunday is Father's Day, and whether you're the kind that celebrates dad by throwing him a party or by quietly spending a special evening with him, the memories our dads have given us are etched into our minds, some good, some bad, and some ugly. Well, Father's Day is a day for the fonder memories, so here's KALW's Julie Kane as she brings us this personal essay about growing up with her single dad.
I spent most of my childhood up in the air. My dad was a pilot.
I'm Steve Kane. I'm Julie's father.
He loved to fly.
I just loved the feeling of being up in the air, kind of above the machines on the ground that were just kind of crawling along and picking their way, because you could go anywhere.
Some of my earliest memories are of sitting in the cockpit next to my dad, bursting up through the clouds and watching the infinite blue sky out the windows of these little single-engine planes. Sometimes my dad would even let me take the controls. He'd guide me from the pilot seat as I made the wings dip left and right. We'd swoop and glide together, just the two of us, high above the patchwork landscape below. My dad started raising me on his own when I was 2 years old, but really, he'd been taking care of me from day one.
I just remember that when you were born, and I came back to our house, and I looked in this little crib, and there you were. That was the first time it really occurred to me that you were part of my life.
My mother was mentally ill, but nobody really knew it until after I was born.
your mom seemed like had imaginary friends and stuff like that, and there was stuff going on, and then she wasn't a mother in the sense that she didn't spend time with you. And so I ended up doing most of that, and I just thought, this is crazy.
My parents got a divorce, and my dad went to court to get custody of me.
And were you scared to go at it alone, or?
Absolutely not, no, because I'd been doing that anyway.
He wasn't scared of being a single dad, but he was scared of losing me. It was the early 1970s, and it was really rare for a man to get sole custody of a little girl. So the night before the judge handed down his decision, my dad flew us from Wichita, Kansas, where we lived, to Barstow, California, where there was this little airport my dad knew about. We spent the night in a motel room. I have no memory of this, but I imagine us huddled together under the covers, watching TV, waiting out the long night. My dad wasn't taking any chances. If he didn't get custody, he was ready to go on the run with me. Luckily, the judge decided in his favor.
That was a really major part of my life and has been ever since.
Being raised by a bachelor dad wasn't always easy, but it was an adventure. As a toddler, my favorite toy was a screwdriver. I carried it with me everywhere, even to bed. Instead of playing with Barbies, I made families out of my dad's socket wrenches. I wore mismatched clothes and had raggedy haircuts and was impervious to germs and dirt. I didn't have a mother, but I did have a champion. One who followed his passions and taught me to do the same.
Yeah, tower, Cessna 19897 inbound to land with Papa.
My dad loved to fly, but he couldn't afford to buy a plane. So he did PR for airplane companies most of his life and in return got access to planes whenever he wanted. Before that, though, he was a journalist who did newspaper reporting and before that, radio for the Navy. He was following in his dad's footsteps.
Now it's time for the 445 News with New Mexico's senior news personality reporting.
Thank you, Dan. Good evening, everyone. Well, the State Department has said no to Premier Castro's request that the U.S. lift its economic blockade on Cuba, and that, of course, doesn't surprise anybody.
My grandpa was on the radio in Albuquerque, New Mexico from the 1950s to the 1970s. He was born in Brooklyn, the son of Russian immigrants, and he was a self-made man. Even his name was his own creation, Benjamin Texas Kane.
My father was strict about most things, except that as I was growing up and looking back, my father... Well, he always wanted to have a business with his son.
My dad and my grandpa started a pizza restaurant together long before I was born. But before they could make a success of it, my dad fell in love with flying.
And even though it was his dream to have the family business, you know, he said, go follow your dreams. And so I did.
Do you feel like there's, like, a lesson you got from your dad, like something he always told you or, I don't know, something you feel like you really learned from Ben Kane?
He always taught me to look for the good in people, that everybody had something to offer. And I learned to let you go, you know, because of that. Experience to let you find your way and do what you wanted to do. And it's been interesting because my dad was a writer and a journalist, you know, and a news broadcaster and did news commentaries on radio and television. And so I became a journalist, and then you did too.
It's interesting, you know, that you said your dad wanted to have a father and son business, and mm-hmm. in a funny way, we do have a family business.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're right. Yeah. Because we've all done exactly the same thing. And I remember my daughter, you, saying that you didn't want to do what your dad did, you know, and here you are doing the same thing, which pleases me to no end.
My dad doesn't fly anymore. Illness and age have put him in the passenger seat. But the gift he gave me is the same gift his dad gave him. He taught me how to fly.
And I love you to pieces.
I love you too, Dad.
For Cross Currents, this is Julie Kane.
You can post a special moment with your dad at our Facebook page. It's KALW News. Or you can get in touch through our website. It's kalw.org. And that's where you can subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Hanau Baba, Julie Kane, Artyom's Kunahoffs, Leila Day, Lupe Hernandez, Buffy Almendares, Taha Lanier, Audrey Dilling, Erica Mu, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also, thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. The song you're listening to now is by TV Mike and the Scarecrows. You can hear them this Friday at Café du Nord in San Francisco. The show begins at 9 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.